Good morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, Finn at OffbeatOregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Thanks for loading me down and queuing me up, and I do hope you enjoy the show. It was the Ides of March, March 15th, 1882. A.H. Crooks and Stephen Jory were blazing the boundary lines of some land, cutting big marks in trees to mark what they claimed was their property, near the ranch of a man named Lucius Langdon, near Prineville. The two of them broke for lunch, and when they returned, Langdon was waiting for them, with a shotgun. A few noisy, smoky seconds later, Crooks and Jory were dead, and their killing marked the start of a 2-year period of rule by masked gunmen and lynch mobs in the Prineville area that sounds today like the plot of a Louis L'Amour novel, or maybe Zane Grey, the story of the Crook County Vigilantes. Quote, "When a band of men went outside the law to revenge the killings, they also hanged an innocent man and started a rule by gun and rope that is one of the blackest chapters in Oregon's history," local rancher and future sheriff James Blakely told a Morning Oregonian reporter many years later. Blakely himself was no unbiased observer of the vigilante phenomenon. He would, 2 years later, be the leader of the community group formed to oppose them. Blakely's anti-vigilante group called itself the Moonshiners because they kept watch when the moon was out, looking for masked riders. Remember now, this was decades before Prohibition, when the term moonshiner would come to mean something completely different. Blakely's chief opponent was a frontier character named Colonel William Bud Thompson, a hard-fisted rancher gunfighter and sometime newspaper man. Although Colonel Thompson denied involvement with the vigilantes, he wrote an eloquent defense of their methods, along with a noticeably vigilante-friendly version of the whole story, in his book 30 years later. It is also worth noting that when he left Prineville, he went to Alturas, California, and vigilante activity broke out there as well. He denied involvement with that, too. In any case, it is chiefly from the reminiscences of these two men, Blakely and Thompson, that we have the story of the vigilante era, and their stories, as you can imagine, diverge wildly in places. According to Blakely's account, he, Blakely, was in town with Langdon's hired hand, W.H. Harrison, when he heard the news that Langdon had gunned down Crooks and Jory. Both Blakely and Harrison hurried to join a posse that was coming together to go out to Langdon's ranch and bring him in. Another posse went to Langdon's brother's place in case he'd gone there, but the killer was found and arrested at his own ranch. Colonel Thompson's account is a bit different. In it, he says Harrison, the hired hand, wasn't with Blakely and didn't ride with the posse. Instead, he was hiding out with Langdon at the brother's place. Thompson also claims they found 10 men who were completely unknown to them in Langdon's brother's house. It's this story that most convinces me that Thompson's is an unreliable account, for in it, these 10 armed men are not arrested and nothing is ever heard from them again, as if they were minor characters in a Western pulp magazine story. It's almost certain that he made them up in order to claim the Langdons were the leaders of a gang of outlaws, a gang, conveniently, made up entirely of strangers from out of town, and to justify what was about to happen to Harrison, the hired hand, and more on that in a minute. In any case, the posse brought Langdon home under arrest, with Harrison riding along with them as a posse member. Langdon was entrusted to Deputy Sheriff John Lucky, and everyone went to bed. Very early the next morning, though, as Deputy Lucky was sitting by the stove, the vigilantes made their first move. Quote, "The door was suddenly opened, and I was caught and thrown backward on the floor and firmly held, while my eyes were blinded, and immediately a pistol was fired rapidly 5 or 6 times. I heard someone groan about the time the firing ceased," Deputy Lucky wrote in a subsequent report to his boss. "I went to Langdon and found him dead. I looked around, and a masked man stood at each door, warning by ominous signs for no one to undertake to leave the room." The vigilantes then grabbed Harrison. It's not clear whether he was in the room with Langdon when the masked riders burst in or whether he came later, attracted by the activity. Ignoring his panic-stricken pleas, the masked men put a rope around his neck and used a horse to drag him through the streets of Prineville to the bridge, where they strung his by now lifeless body from a banister. It was the beginning of the vigilantes' reign of their own special kind of law and order in Prineville Country, enforced by masked riders with drawn guns and ready ropes. Quote, "The vigilantes who banded together that night to shoot Langdon and lynch the innocent Harrison stuck together for 2 years, getting bolder and bolder," Blakely told the Oregonian. The group took to sending death threats with skull and crossbones emblems to various people around town, some of whom certainly were rustlers and criminals, but others of whom were simply fellow ranchers opposed to their methods. Colonel Thompson claims the escalation in vigilante activity was in response to a bold increase in crime, apparently by the unknown gang of 10 outlaws first encountered in Langdon's brother's house. Public opinion seems to have been on the vigilante's side at first, which gives some credence to Colonel Thompson's claim that the group formed out of frustration with ineffective local law enforcement, but it didn't stay on their side for long. In fact, it seems to have turned on them later that year, in December, when the vigilantes lynched a horse jockey named Charles Luster. The vigilantes claimed that Luster had been about to steal some horses, but most folks in town just happened to know that Luster had just refused to throw a horse race at the behest of some prominent vigilantes who had bet against him. The sudden declaration that Luster was a horse thief had seemed disturbingly convenient. Moreover, in the process of getting even with Luster, the vigilantes had killed another young man, a friend of Luster's who was with him that night. The two of them ended up hanging from a juniper tree together with the rancher they'd been having dinner with, and the rancher they'd been working for was shot through a window at a Prineville saloon that same night. Colonel Thompson later tried to claim the four of them had been part of a gang that had ridden through Prineville earlier in the day, shooting into the air and threatening to burn the town down, but his is the only account that mentions anything of this kind. Again, it seems likely that he was just making up a story to justify the vigilantes. After this incident, the residents of Prineville definitively turned against the vigilantes. But law enforcement was still extraordinarily light and ineffective throughout the Prineville area. Sure, the vigilantes were throwing their weight around, but could anything be done about them? And would a crook county without the vigilantes be even worse? More innocent people were going to have to die before the town would commit to doing something about it. We'll talk about how that played out in next week's column. This story was first published on November 25th of 2012 under the headline, When the Vigilantes Ruled Prineville. Key sources include works by Herbert Lundy, William Thompson, and Phil Brogan. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening, and I do hope you enjoyed it. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. What you're listening to is a reading from one of more than 300 newspaper columns published between 2008 and today. Other Offbeat Oregon goodies include a Facebook page, a Twitter feed, a fleet of Pinterest boards, a ton of great historic photos, and a bunch more stuff, including visuals for today's show and full citations to sources, all accessible via our hub page at offbeatoregon.com. The podcast is covered under a Creative Commons license. For details of that, see offbeatoregon.com/cc. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Questions, critiques, ideas for a show I might do? Email me at finn@offbeatoregon.com. You can also ping me on Twitter @offbeatoregon. Episodes of Offbeat Oregon History come out every weekday morning around 6 a.m., so the next one will be on your device and ready to go soon. Until then, go fill up the rest of today with good stuff. Bye now.